I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Leave no one behind. It is the rallying cry of a military looking after its own, romanticized by Hollywood in films like Behind Enemy Lines and Black Hawk Down. But the real story is a little more complicated. Despite the dramatic rescue of 19-year-old supply clerk Jessica Lynch in one of the few feel-good stories to come out of this war so far, there are 70,000 service people still officially missing from World War II, 2,000 from Vietnam, 15 Americans still believed held in North Korea. And at least one Navy pilot, Scott Spiker, the first casualty reported from Gulf War I, is still listing as missing captured, and has friends who insist he is still alive somewhere in Iraq. Despite the jubilation around Jessica Lynch's rescue, sobering questions about the search and rescue process remain. How to go in, when to go in, and at what cost? Connection listeners, how long should the military look for the missing? How much firepower should be expended in finding one of our own, especially if one rescue might cost dozens of other lives? And are all soldiers, should all soldiers, from the supply clerk to the highly trained combat pilot, be equal when it comes to rescue efforts? You're invited to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have two guests with us to help us explore the issue. Fred Kiley co-authored the book Honor Bound, American Prisoners of War in Southeast Asia, 1961 to 1973. He is a retired Air Force colonel who now teaches at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. Hello, Fred.
Good morning.
Also joining us is Jay Veit, who wrote Codename Bright Light, which is a history of rescue efforts in Vietnam. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're delighted you could be here. And just moments ago, here's something we can all listen to, which is what we heard from President Bush speaking at Camp Lejeune about that rescue.
Two nights ago, Marines and Special Operations Forces set out on a daring rescue mission, and thanks to their skill and courage, a brave young soldier is now free.
Certainly a momentous occasion for many people in the services and people just all over the country. Fred, are you surprised by how much attention this event has gotten?
Oh, no. I think it's very understandable. That's a very heroic thing that was accomplished. The interest in the prisoners of war since Vietnam in particular has been a major thing, something new in warfare since World War II in Korea. So it doesn't surprise me at all.
Jay, do you think it makes any difference that, I almost cringe to say this, but that it was a woman who was rescued?
No, I think that the armed forces in general and the nation are jubilant that she was rescued. It's really the first successful rescue of an American since the Korean War.
So no difference, male, female, we would have equally welcomed anyone at that point.
Exactly. It's one of the credos of the armed forces that we don't leave anybody behind if possible.
Take us back a little bit. Colonel, maybe we can start this one with you, because when you think about the World War II experience, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems as if when a soldier was captured then, basically they were thrown into a POW camp. They either tried to escape, sometimes rarely succeeded, but pretty much just held on, hoped to survive until the war ended and they could finally go home. Was that the case? Did we have a different view of prisoners of war then?
Well, it's a yes and no answer, of course. The situations were different in the Pacific and in the European theater. There were a lot of organized camps in the European theater. Treatment was, in many of them, fairly good. In others, it was terrible, chiefly because of weather or location. In the Pacific, treatment was much worse. In the hands of the Japanese, a much higher percentage died. The opportunities for rescue in those years were far more difficult even to attempt than, say, in Vietnam. I think that's the major change. Jay's book, which is the book, by the way, and if I may, I'd like to offer him my congratulations.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's a great job. The efforts that he used that term, Bright Light, that was the Operation Codename for searching for American prisoners, mainly in South Vietnam. It did result in one rescue, which had an unfortunate consequence. A young soldier was rescued in one of the many sweeps that Operation Bright Light made, as Jay well knows. He was hit in the head by a guard as the guard ran out, and he survived 10 or 12 days, died back in Walter Reed Hospital. But I think we had several hundred South Vietnamese that were rescued, but that was the only American, and it was a tragic circumstance.
Connection listeners, we're interested in hearing what you have to say about the cost and potential successes of POW rescues. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or if you have a personal experience to share with us. I was struck, both Fred and Jay, in reading some of the stories from World War II. You know, even inside those POW camps, life was pretty horrific. It just hasn't been in recent years that this has been the case.
Well, I think that's true, but again, some of the camps were not too bad. Some of the flying officer camps that the Germans ran, for example, some of the NCO camps in Europe. In other camps, depending on where it was and who the commanders were, much different. On the other side, in the Pacific, it was horror for many of the camps, and the death rate and the savagery, the lack of concern for the PWs was terrible.
That
involved the people who were signatories, by the way, to the Geneva Conventions.
And that played out in Korea and Vietnam. Korea was probably even worse than the Japanese, and the Vietnamese were some shades even worse than the Koreans and the Chinese. I guess it's like comparing different levels of hell. The death rates in both camps for the Koreans and the North Vietnamese approached in some areas in South Vietnam close to 50%. They weren't quite as bad in the north, as Fred well knows, but the torture up there was far more severe than it was in the south. So it was sort of a different size of a bad coin.
Mm-hmm. Is there training that all soldiers receive for this kind of thing, Fred?
Yes. It varies, of course, depending on the missions, but there is a general program of survival, evasion, escape, and so forth, resistance in captivity. All soldiers, all airmen, all sailors, all Coast Guardsmen, and so forth receive that. But then there's additional special training for people who are in a higher risk, pilots, special forces, and so on.
Well, which brings up an interesting point. I would imagine that someone like Jessica Lynch, who was trained to be a supply clerk, probably never imagined that she would be where she wound up. She may have gotten, what, 1 hour course in basic training, whereas someone else would get something much more intensive. Jay?
That's true, although she would have been trained on the code of conduct, which is, as Fred mentioned, there's sort of a basic level of training for all soldiers, and then depending upon the skill level and the risk factor of a pilot or special forces, they're going to get much more intense training on how to resist interrogation, how to survive on the land, different factors that they can use to try to signal rescuing forces to reach them, whereas someone like Jessica probably is not going to get that detailed of training.
Well, it's interesting how she reacted, though. The Washington Post was reporting this morning that she shot several Iraqi soldiers during the ambush that resulted in her capture. I'm quoting now from an Associated Press story that just ran about how she kept firing even after she had several gunshot wounds and finally ran out of ammunition.
I read that story, too, and all I can say is God bless her.
Mm-hmm.
Who formulates the policy about how prisoners are to be searched for, to be rescued? You know, there's this Hollywood view of if they're holding one of our own, we're going to go swooping in with the helicopters and we're going to get them out of there.
Well, Jay, let me defer to you on that because you're more current than I am.
Well, it all starts with intelligence. You first have to determine whether or not, let's say, a pilot shot down. So the first thing you've got to determine, did he eject? Did he make it out? Is he on the ground signaling? The next thing is, can we get to him? And so if they can get to him in a reasonably short amount of time without having to fly through a wall of anti-aircraft to do it, then there's immediately search and rescue helicopters are launched to try to rescue him. If the man is then picked up immediately, can they rescue him during transit? Then you have a third scenario where a guy might be in a camp And again, it goes back to intelligence. Can we recognize where the guy's at? Can we get a good sense of the locations of the guards, their schedule, what kind of defenses are around there? But the overall decision on who's going to make a launch or rescue is going to be dependent upon the intelligence, the locations, status of the men, a whole host of factors have to go into play to make a determination. Can we launch a successful rescue to get a guy?
And in fact, the rescue of Private Lynch apparently came from a tip from an Iraqi pharmacist who had treated her in the hospital.
And that's where most of them usually come from. Somebody escaped, somebody internal to the camp, escapes from the camp and gives or gives us an information and say, hey, I know where an American POW is. And then you have to hope that they actually can pinpoint it on a map and say, yes, this person's right here, right now. And you have to also hope that the intelligence is timely enough. If this guy had come out 2 weeks later and said, oh, yeah, I was helping an American POW, but it was 2 months ago, that intelligence is useful but not helpful in terms of launching a rescue.
I believe that was true in South Vietnam, was it not, Jay, that
yes.
There were raids that went into places where there had been American POWs, but they had been moved.
Exactly right. People would take 3 days to actually, you know, they would escape from a camp, take 3 days to fight their way through the jungle, get to an American. And sometimes they were quite accurate in being able to say the American was right here. By the time they actually got rescue forces in there, the VC had pulled them out. And sometimes they were so hot on the trail that they actually come across, you know, cooking meals and utensils that they left behind, and they escape into the jungle and be impossible to find them.
Gail, I might interject at this point just to make sure we have an accurate perspective that the numbers of prisoners in recent years are a great deal lower than they were, say, in Korea. The total number of POWs in Vietnam, military POWs in Vietnam, is about a tenth or an 11th maybe of the number in Korea.
How do you
account
for that?
There were just fewer captured. That sounds simplistic, but the
does seem logical,
large,
though, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's a large number of troops on both sides in a pitched battle. It's, for example, in Korea, particularly, say, the Chosin Reservoir, where the bulk of our POWs were taken. In Vietnam, that didn't happen. There were no huge battles of that size which would lend to large numbers of POWs on both sides. But for Vietnam, the number that's usually given is around 770 military POWs for 12 years of warfare, and that's rather a small number, which then makes rescue, the numbers of people who are rescued, even smaller because the pool is so much smaller.
We need to take a break here, but when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation and also get into some of the moral implications of what we're talking about here. If you send out 30 people to rescue one, how do you make that decision? Connection listeners, when a single rescue might cost dozens of lives, is it still the right thing to do to attempt the rescue? And should only those soldiers expected to be on the front lines receive prisoner survival and conduct training? Should that be something for every soldier? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.
At this point, she is safe. She's been retrieved. And some brave souls put their lives on the line to make this happen. Loyal to a creed that they know. That they'll never leave a fallen comrade and never embarrass their country.
That comment from Vincent Brooks yesterday at the CENTCOM briefing. I'm joined on the line now with Lynn O'Shea, who has been working with this issue for the National Alliance of POW and MIA Families since its inception in 1990. She joins us from her office in Queens, New York. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning.
You just heard what Vincent Brooks had to say. Is that the real deal as far as you're concerned?
In real time, absolutely. If there is evidence or intelligence comes in that they have a chance to rescue a POW during an action, they will act on it. There is no question, no hesitation. The military moves. The problem comes after the conflict or war is over, and the decisions are no longer military but political, and that's where the problems lie.
So as much as we want to hear nobody's left behind, that's not always the whole story.
Well, no, and the most recent case, there are questions going back Korea, Vietnam, as well as World War II, but the most recent case and well-known is that of Navy Captain Scott Spiker, who was or could have been left behind in the last Gulf War.
Tell us a little bit more about that story.
Well, Spiker was shot down on the first day of the Gulf War, and he was immediately declared killed in action, and his remains were never recovered. Subsequent to that decision, starting in 1991, intelligence reports were reaching the U.S. that a pilot had survived an incident and was in Baghdad in the custody of Saddam Hussein. And those reports trickled in. And then in 1994, I believe it was, there was a report that his crash site had been located by some, I believe they were Bedouin, who were out hunting. And they brought that information to the United States. And there was very quickly plans were drawn up to send a covert operation in to investigate the crash site and see if they could recover remains or get some clue as to what happened to Scott Spiker. And when the plan was brought into the Joint Chiefs of Staff, it was vetoed. Instead, they opted for the political method of sending a message to Saddam Hussein, requesting permission to go in. The permission was delayed for approximately 8 months, and when the U.S. teams got to the site to examine it, they had found that the site had already been examined, and critical parts of the aircraft that would have told a lot were missing.
Lynn, let me ask you, what brought you into this issue?
Oh, I got involved actually before even the alliance was formed, and I was just looking for information on the soldier whose name I had, you know, from the bracelets in Vietnam when everybody wore POW bracelets, and I was trying to find out information on him, and it just snowballed.
Well, Lynn, thank you so much for giving us your perspective. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
And now let me go back with our other two guests who are helping us explore the issue this hour. Fred Kiley co-authored the book Honor Bound, American Prisoners of War in Southeast Asia, 1961 to 1973. He's a retired Air Force colonel who now teaches at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And also joining us is Jay Veit, who wrote Codename Bright Light, A History of Rescue Efforts in Vietnam. Gentlemen, Lynn brings up a very interesting case of Scott Spiker, and I'd be interested in hearing from each of you as to what is the military's obligation to go after its own, and does that obligation ever expire? Fred, maybe you start.
Sure. I think it runs very, very deep. There's a great deal of judgment involved, as his case shows, and many others. The commitment is there. It's a question of whether it's possible, and it begins, as Jay has said, with accurate intelligence. I might add that the commitment of the government as well to the search for the MIAs may be a great deal stronger than the general public appreciates. I knew the assistant secretary under whom the search for the MIAs fell and who funded it. And just in 1 5-year period in the late 90s, the cost was over $100 million a year for the search in, mainly in North Vietnam of crash sites and attempts to find better intelligence. Some very interesting things were done. Some very intelligent things were done. Many of the aviators who were lost up in North Vietnam and Laos had coordinates of loss, the last known location where they were either in the air or about to crash or actually crashed. And in the north, many of those had been inspected by teams out of the embassy since the embassy was established up in Hanoi. And they began to widen the search, just to put it in a very simple way. They might take the coordinates and then go a quarter of a mile out east, north, west, and so forth. And that turned up remains. They took money to villages in North Vietnam where there had been losses, Americans down during the war, and they put the money out as reward money for information. This was done in contradiction to what had been the policy earlier. If a flyer was downed in North Vietnam and was killed in the ground, allowed to die in the ground, exposed to mobs which might have killed him and that kind of thing, the people who did that were in trouble because the North Vietnamese government wanted as many POWs as they could have, live POWs, because they used them for propaganda, to try to exploit them, to make statements appear on in film and that sort of thing. And this represented a change in policy. They now wanted that information, were willing to pay for it. And that unearthed another group of sets of remains over the last 10 or 12 years, which were gradually returned. Unfortunately, a year or so ago, in a helicopter crash in North Vietnam, which a number of Americans who were on a site inspection team were killed, so too with them was killed a colonel general, a brigadier general equivalent named Bien, B-I-E-N, who had been assigned the duty by the North Vietnamese government to run these investigations, assist the Americans. And he told me in a brief chat we had in D.C. that this was his job. He did that to the satisfaction of the Americans or died, whichever came first.
Hmm.
Now, he was a combat
Let me stop you there. Let me stop you there, Fred, if I may. It's a fascinating story. We have lots of callers who have been wanting to get in on the conversation. Let's go to James, who's phoning in from South Carolina, from somewhere on Interstate 95. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to put my idea in. I'm an ex-Green Beret from 5th Special Forces Group, and I know many members of the Sante Raiders. Y'all remember people like that and learn lessons from them. Because we need to change our public policy about the way in which we handle POWs. And I think that really the solution to the problem is very simple. Number one, we have the technology today to be able to put little devices of some sort into a person's body to where, like the GPS, they could be tracked. Number two, as soldiers, we should take a vow when we go in that we will not be taken alive, as this young lady fought just as hard as she could, to where there was nothing else she could do. She ran out of ammunition. She had two broken legs, a broken arm, had taken a few bullet wounds, I applaud the lady for doing the best that she could. And, I applaud those men that went in and saved her and brought her back out. Were I in her position, if they could not come in and take me out as they did her, I would rather them be able to know where I was from the global positioning and drop a bomb and kill me and keep me from being able to be a pawn of the other governments or the terrorists that were holding me, to keep me from going through the pain of the torture and all that people have gone through generations, just as they did on the death march, from the Japanese. There are.
Thanks, James, for the point. We take your point, and it certainly is an interesting one. Jay, what's your line on that? I mean, that's pretty fierce. You're not going to take me alive. Should that be what we tell soldiers?
Well, I think that's a very difficult thing to mandate to people. I think that there are some situations where some people don't want to be taken alive. There are situations where people are going to, put up a good fight and then realize the futility of it and surrender. And I think that's an individual choice more than anything the military could mandate.
All right, let's go to Al, who's phoning in from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Al.
Hi, how are you?
Very well.
I have a hard time believing that guy who made the last comment was really a real veteran with a comment like that. But I was in the Navy on active duty, and I got to tell you that, one of the great motivating factors for our fighting forces is the fact that you are told, you are promised that they will not leave you behind. If you get captured, if you get killed, your body will be recovered. They will do the best that they can. Even to the point of if your body is lost at sea, they will try their best to let your family know, the coordinates. And the fact, you can make your peace with your maker, but, as long as your family knows, if they don't have the body, they know where it is, you know that somebody's going to make sure that either you come back alive or that your body does or your family knows where you are. It's a huge motivating factor to go, okay, that's taken care of. I've settled all my debts. Let's roll.
All right. Thanks for the comment, Al. Jay?
That's absolutely correct, and that is probably the single or number one factor that we preach to the troops is that we are always out there looking for you, hence the reason why we have rescue operations, hence the way we have specialized units designed to go out and do search and rescue. It is a morale factor. It is a moral factor, and I think it's a practical factor. You obviously want to try and recover a guy who's been trained in an F-18 fighter pilot and you spend $1 million training the guy. You want to recover somebody like that. So I think those three factors are the most critical thing that we use to improve and keep the morale of our troops up.
But is that a given? Has that always been taken for granted in some way? Or has that evolved over time, this notion of we'll come and get you no matter what? Clearly, it would be an essential ingredient in building a team even before anyone gets to the battlefield, a good reason for people to fight and to be there for each other and with each other. But is that the way it's always been, Fred?
Not always, but I think with the present situation where it's an all-volunteer force, it's vital, more vital than in a general army of conscripts, because everybody is valuable in a volunteer army, more so than in a general conscript army. I think that's true in most nations. Look at the Russian armies in World War II, where the life of the individual was of far less importance to the saving of the cities, the Stalingrad campaign, for example. So I think that's a part of it. I would say to Al, we're neighbors, by the way. I'm from Acton originally. That I think the fact that it is an all-volunteer force now makes that commitment that we're going to come get you much stronger than ever before. And I don't want to judge, you know, previous campaigns. And I think that the individual soldier can count on that far more today than he could, say, 100 years ago in general warfare.
And you agree it's a good motivator?
Absolutely. Sure thing.
Let's go to Dave now. Thanks for the call, Al. Dave has been waiting to speak with us from Medford, Massachusetts. Hello, Dave.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask your guests if they had anything to add about the regarding the Mayaguez incident, which occurred about 25 or 30 years ago. I know that was not a case where we were at war. This was a case where the Cambodians, the Khmer Rouge, had taken one of our merchant ships hostage. And we did go in there, and we did rescue the entire crew, but I think, now correct me if I'm wrong, I think we lost, we rescued about 40, and in the process we lost about 40 of our own. And did we learn anything by that?
That well, sounds like a question for Fred, although let's hear from both of you. Fred first.
Sure. I just have a quick point. There is a book that I could refer Dave to. It's called The Long Road Home. The author is Vernon Davis, D-A-V-I-S, and it's published by the Office of the Secretary of Defense Historical Office. It's a government printing office book. You can find it online in the GPO catalog. There's information in there that I think would answer his questions.
Let me ask Jay, though, what about the larger point that Dave was just making of how what kind of things do you weigh in this decision in its moral implications? In the Lynch case, for example, there was a diversionary battle that happened nearby involving 30 to 40 vehicles. Now, if many of those soldiers had been killed at that point, don't you have to weigh whether it was worth it?
Well, that's the great $64,000 question on this whole POW rescue effort. Let me just go back to the previous caller's statement. They didn't rescue any of the crewmen from the Mayaguez. The Cambodians actually released them. They had launched Marine forces into Koh Tang Island thinking that the Mayaguez crew was still in the area. But that's a great question. William Westmoreland asked this question directly to the men at the Joint Personnel Recovery Center during the Vietnam War. They asked him, he asked them point blank, how much is one American's life worth? And again, it's this whole balancing act between of, you know, can you get into the camp? Can you rescue the American without him getting killed, without you losing a bunch of people? what's the enemy situation there? So there's all these different factors that have to be weighed before somebody says, some commander says, okay, we're going to go in there and risk all these men and this equipment and a potential POW on this rescue operation.
Dave, I don't know if you have served in the military yourself, but I'm wondering, where would you draw that line?
Well, no, I haven't served in the military. There are two issues here as far as what we've learned. One is, are we willing to risk that much life? And the other one is, do we learn anything in terms of tactics? And apparently our intelligence was severely lacking if the crewmen were actually released and we were still going in.
You're talking about the Mayaguez.
Right, regarding the Mayaguez. So I'm wondering if we at least took any lessons from that as far as how to go about rescuing people.
Well, we learned that in that instance that, again, you know, intelligence is, you know, people blame intelligence, but sometimes it's not easy to get as people think it is. Good intelligence is probably the hardest thing in the world to get. We went into Koh Tang Island thinking that the Americans were there. We were under sort of a deadline to go in there, and they also did not know that the Cambodians had dug in as much as they had in that island. We didn't know they were heavily reinforced. So they took a calculated risk, and in that instance, it was wrong. There have been other efforts where they took a calculated risk and they were right. So, again, it is a question, it's a decision a commander has to wrestle with, and ultimately they're responsible for it.
Jay, are there rules about this sort of thing, or is it really just up to the commander in the field to have to make that call?
Well, the Mayaguez went clear up to President Ford to make the decision, obviously. When you get down to sort of the lower levels, basically a POW rescue operation, depending upon where it's at. Let's take Vietnam for an example. If it was within Vietnam, you still had to get clearance by the embassy there to go and do it. If you're talking about a cross-border operation in Cambodia and Laos, then you got much more difficult. You had to go to SINCPAC, you had to go clear up to the White House to get authorization. And that time delay, when intelligence is very critical, is what one of the reasons why we weren't very successful in Vietnam, because it would often drag so long trying to make a decision. The camps had moved, or the intelligence was stale, and so it would just cause failure.
Jay, hold the thought. There's lots more to be said about how it was handled in Vietnam and how it's being handled now. POWs, search and rescue, and the moral implications of what we do and how we go in or not. Connection listeners, you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. We're continuing our conversation on search and rescue attempts, like the one we just saw with PFC Jessica Lynch. And we are speaking this hour with Colonel Fred Kiley, who co-authored the book Honor Bound, American Prisoners of War in Southeast Asia, 1961 to 1973. He's a professor of English at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And Jay Veit, who wrote Codename Bright Light, The Untold Story of U.S. POW Rescue Attempts During the Vietnam War. I want to ask Jay, you were speaking a moment ago about how this played out in Vietnam, and I'm wondering how much impact did it have when families of the missing were so insistent that this be paid attention to on every level, public perception in government, in the military. I remember many people, thousands of people probably wore the MIA bracelets.
Well, it had a tremendous impact on government policy. I think one of my favorite lines from reading all the documents that I was going through when I was writing Codename Bright Light was a comment from Frank Sieverts, who was the State Department's main point man during the Vietnam War on the POWMI issue. And he made a comment that that the best thing that the U.S. government could do would be to take the propaganda weapon out of the North Vietnamese hands, was to completely ignore the POWMI issue, to tell them it wasn't worth their time, but that they couldn't do it because 1,000 wives were insisting that their government pay close attention to this. So I think that the families had a tremendous impact during the war and obviously after the war. After the war, as Fred mentioned earlier, I don't think people realize that the efforts of the American family organizations have created a sort of groundswell about POWs and MIAs throughout the entire world, and it's now a very important factor in post-war issues.
Let's go back to our phone lines. John is calling in from Newton, Massachusetts. Hello, John.
Hi, Gail. How are you doing? question, or rather a point made. I was in the Navy back 35 years ago during the Pueblo incident when it was taken by the North Koreans again. And I actually had served with a bunch of the guys who ended up on the Pueblo.
Just remind us for a second, John, what was
Pueblo
that exactly?
Pueblo was an HUTR, what they call a communications intelligence ship, which was full of Navy guys primarily, with a commander by the name of Butcher, who became somewhat of the scapegoat by the Navy and by the military for what happened. They were taken off the coast of Korea by the North Koreans and held captive for, and I forget how long the period was, a year and a half, something like that. I guess my point is that those guys were not, had no training whatsoever. Navy guys generally only are taught how to jump off a ship and swim through burning water, that type of thing, and hope to God somebody will pick you up. But there was no training other than that for any kind of prisoner of war type situation. More to the point, unfortunately, I was in the Aleutians at the time and on the radio with them when they were being captured by the Koreans. And the thing is that I'm sort of aware of the fact that we made pretty damn poor effort to do any kind of help at all to them. Yes. I'm just wondering if you
I might be able to shed some light on that. The timing was very important. This was during the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, and our resources were all in Vietnam. It was timed deliberately by the North Koreans to do that. It was a clear violation of international law. I mean, the Pueblo was well out in open waters. They were not in territorial waters. The question of how do we go in and rescue a ship captured and tied up in a port in a country like North Vietnam with a large military, it was weighed, I know, but the rescue efforts, given the fact that we had all this material and people in the Tet Offensive already tied up, would it have been worth it? And the answer that the JCS, I'm sure, arrived at was no. We couldn't do it successfully, and we'd probably get many of them killed. So it was negotiated, and the crew was released. And I think that John's timing is right. It was a year or a little more than that. And nearly everybody did survive that incident and were released.
John, stay with us for a minute. I want to ask Jay about when this matter of training changed. Was there a difference? This was a gentleman who was in the Navy in the 60s, didn't get training. Did the early Vietnam soldiers not get training, and then it happened later as they were more and more were taken prisoner? Or
well, there
when did
was
that happen?
There was a shift from what happened in Korea, well, actually from what happened in World War I, from what happened in Korea, then what happened afterwards in Vietnam. I'm going to defer to Fred on this one, since he probably knows more than I do.
Fred, is there a point at which we can mark when really serious training began?
Well, it was always there for the people who were greatly at risk. Aviators who were flying in enemy territory, for example. But after the Pueblo, in fact, there were changes in the services, additions to the code of conduct training, which everybody got and still does today, of course, to consider the possibility of what you do if you are taken prisoner. The prisoners in North Vietnam, largely the aviators who were there from beginning in 64 till 73, they will tell you that after the Pueblo incident, 1968, the later prisoners who came up were shot down and captured and came up into the prison camps in Hanoi did have changes in the code of conduct training they were given. It was a more flexible code to try to help them better meet a captivity situation where they were going to be exploited for propaganda with torture or with various other methods that the enemy might use. And they were trained in something called ruses and stratagems, that is, how do you stretch an interrogation out a long time? How do you play dumb? How do you pretend to give information, but it's not good, and that sort of thing, which was different from the training, particularly of the earliest captives up in North Vietnam. It was a slogan, the Big Four and nothing more, taken from the strictures that are in the Code of Conduct taken from the Geneva Conventions originally.
John,
that
we have
a prisoner was. I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead and finish the thought, and then we want to let John back in just for a quick comment.
You bet. That the prisoners were obligated to give name, rank, serial number, and date of birth, which is an obligation so that their names can get to Geneva and get to the countries back home. But it's an unrealistic expectation that under torture that anybody could hold to that. So that the code of conduct after the Pueblo incident was modified.
John?
Well, frankly, I'm unaware of any kind of change in the code of conduct or any kind of changes that were made, except for the fact that we were provided with a great many more devices to destroy equipment should we, in fact, have any problems with being overrun by another force. I might add, though, however, in the Navy, for the most part, when you're at sea, what you do at sea during peacetime is very much as dangerous as what you do during wartime. Most people aren't shooting at you. It's just a very dangerous environment in the first place. For the most part, the training, though, was abysmal. I mean, I'm a sailor. As a recreational sailor, and I have had much more training after I get out of the service than I have had when I was in the service as far as being able to provide for myself properly should I go overboard or something like that.
All right, John. Thank you so much for the call.
Bye-bye.
We have another John on the line. This one is from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, John.
Good morning. My name is John. I'm a second lieutenant, retired major from the United States Army, forward observer in Vietnam in 1967 through 1969. And as listening to your program and your commentators, I have a different perspective, as do many Vietnam veterans like myself. The moral imperative on this issue of spending hundreds of millions of dollars over long periods of time seeking out the life of one versus the care and nurturing and the recovery of hundreds of thousands of soldiers, sailors, and airmen who have sacrificed. We took an altruistic view and an oath as officers and enlisted people in the armed services of this great country of ours, that we would defend and protect, but that the needs of one did not nearly measure up to needs of the whole, of the great many.
And so
our argument in this issue, and we're a silent argument, we talk among ourselves most often, I've never ever called one of these programs before, but this issue is one where the moral imperative should be on the needs of the many and not to squander precious resources. It takes me over a year, as it does most Vietnam veterans, to get seen by medical people for events that occurred to us. We're underfunding the VA hospitals. We're not taking care of those.
Let's stick to your first point, John, if we may, because it's certainly a very interesting one. You clearly don't buy the no one's going to be left behind. Jay, good point.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with the caller. I think he's confusing. I think his point is that he's trying to say that that the monetary resources that put into post-war MIA remains recovery would be better spent on things like VA hospitals. That's a political decision, but I think that that there is a necessary point for doing some of the work that the Joint Task Force does out there, recovering, because there are thousands of families who do wish to know what happened to their son or brother or husband, and I think that's a very important factor for the government also and for the people.
Jeez.
May I add
for
John, there's an interesting connection here. One of the long-held prisoners of war in North Vietnam, Colonel Bud Day, George Day, Medal of Honor winner for his resistance in captivity, has devoted much of the last 25 years of his life to winning back and the benefits that veterans had been promised, and the government had shied away from medical benefits in particular. And he had made a great advance in that area, won a great decision a short time ago, which was recently reversed by an appellate court, and now that is being appealed. So I think from John's point of view, he is absolutely right, and it's a it's a political, it's a shameful thing that the veterans of the country who need help have to wait incredible lengths of time even to get seen around the country. But there are people who are working on that issue, and one of the best known of all of the prisoners of war, and one of the most heroic, Colonel Bud Day, had made substantial advances in that area and continues to fight for that.
Thank you so much for the call, John. We appreciate it. I want to ask if there is some point at which, if you know that an individual has been taken prisoner, is there a point at which that becomes a diplomatic matter rather than a question of search and rescue? Jay, maybe that's a question for you.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And again, it goes back to circumstances and where they're being held. The Pueblo is a classic example. I mean, there was no way we were going to be able to go in there and rescue those guys without landing an army. So that became a diplomatic position. How are we going to get these guys out without having to change policy or give them $1 billion to do it? So it depends upon, again, the circumstances of how they're captured, where they're captured, and by whom.
And in the few minutes that we have left, I'd like to hear some reflections from each of you on what the policy should be going forward, particularly in a media age where, you know, you see these pictures of the captured folks on TV. You see Shoshana and how terrified she looks, and you want her to get home. And you see Jessica Lynch in her little army hat, and you want to make sure she's okay. Fred, let's start with you.
In terms of a general policy,
A general policy, how do we deal with this going forward?
With the rescue issue or the PW
yes.
issue?
Well,
with rescue?
I guess we've got to limit it because we just have a very brief time.
Well, I'm not a second-guessing talking head. I think the policies that are in place now are fine. And I think the judgment of commanders on the scene who know far more than anybody else as to when to take one of these, we trust those. We've put our faith in those people, and here's an example of where it worked very well. The sad side of that is we have dead bodies, and we probably have some PWs who were executed in the current campaign.
Jay, you've got about 20 seconds. Can you do it?
Sure. I agree with Fred that the policy is fine as it is. I sort of disagreed with the commanders when they were standing up there sort of yelling at the Al Jazeera people for broadcasting that. I think they reacted as commanders and as soldiers to seeing the mutilated bodies. But it's a double-edged sword of that because the intel guys do want to see those pictures. They do want to know who is captive, you know, what sort of shape they are in, because no matter how the war goes, they want to be able to, you know, be able to say to Iraq, okay, you had Joe Smith, and you need to account for Joe Smith.
All right.
Getting those pictures is very important.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Thanks so much to my guests, Colonel Fred Kiley and Jay Veit, both of whose books can be found, I'm sure, on Amazon or somewhere else. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.
To purchase CDs or cassettes of The Connection, please visit us online at theconnection.org or call 1-800-909-9287.